My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host, always so excited to be back with you, getting to have incredible conversations with incredible human beings. And today I am joined by one of the best, Ryan Daniel Moran, founder of Capitalism.com, where he teaches entrepreneurs to build businesses and invest the profits. Ryan is somebody that I have known of for quite some time. We have several mutual friends. I have followed him online, almost to the point where you could consider me a stalker. So hopefully we're going to decompress some of the tension here when a stalker meets a stalky. It like tends to hope it either makes things better or worse. I don't know. We'll see.
But this is getting exciting already. Woo. Woo. All kinds of feelings, Jeff.
Yeah. I like to make things as awkward as possible, as quickly as possible. No, but in all seriousness, somebody turned me on to Ryan's stuff. It was actually at a lunch about 5 years ago with one of our mutual friends, and I've been a fan ever since. And Ryan, now I get to say you're on my show, and I'm excited. Welcome.
Thank you very much for the kind words, Jeff. I've been looking forward to chatting with you.
Yeah. This will be a lot of fun. And I feel like we're going to have so much to talk about. It's like, gosh, where do I even start? Because we're both fundamentally, I think, in the evangelism business, right? Like espousing this thing, this entrepreneurship thing, and this entrepreneurial way that is sadly neglected, I think, in the mainstream conversation. Like, schools don't really talk about it. And yet I believe in the modern world, it literally is people's best shot. And I'm curious, your take on a statement as dramatic as that.
Well, Jeff, I don't know if you know this about my background, but I went to college to become an evangelist.
So
my close followers or close mentees often call me the entrepreneur pastor or the entrepreneur evangelist. So you couldn't be more spot on, Jeff. I did become a pastor just in a different religion, and it was the religion of entrepreneurship. I don't just think it is our best shot, but I do think that it's how we'll solve all of the world's problems, because history tells that 100% of the time. But it is also that it's going to be the only game in town within a few generations. The 9-to-5 is going away. Like, capitalism has won. Capitalism is winning. Entrepreneurship is the game. Now, it will look different, but I think there's a good chance that instead of working a job, you'll work for a DAO, or you'll work with just a few clients. But I think the 9-to-5 employee structure is a dinosaur, and that everyone will be entrepreneurial of some kind. It's just a matter of how fast we allow that to happen and do its thing. So the world is getting freer and freer, despite what a lot of people will say in the media. We have more opportunities. We're getting freer and freer, and we are adjusting to that amount of freedom. We're up-leveling to that amount of freedom. And so entrepreneurship is winning, and it's just a lot of people who are now catching on to keeping up with that.
Well, it wasn't framed as such, but if ever there was an endorsement for the book I'm about to publish, I appreciate you giving it, because that's pretty much exactly what I'm trying to make the case for to the world.
Happy to endorse this book I have not read, Jeff.
Yes. Good. Thank you. But I mean, that's like, we could not be, it's actually frightening how ideologically aligned I am with what you just said. And in my book, I really try to tease out a lot of the biases and a lot of the media driven sort of divisive hype. The language gets very charged when you start talking about capitalism and, you know, especially rich people. And but it sounds like we agree with a lot. Can you talk a little bit more, maybe your views? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you agree with me that the pandemic accelerated some things that were already happening in society, and that, human tragedy aside, I mean, that's, you know, loss of life is tragic, period, the end. But in terms of social and economic trends, these aren't necessarily bad trends to accelerate. Wait, am I putting words in your mouth, or would you agree? And if so, can you expound?
Every major society that has, like, every calamity every major point of tension accelerates where the world is already going. That happens every time there is disaster, every time there is a tremendous amount of hardship, because it becomes the contrast. It becomes the evidence for what we don't want. And then we bounce off of that faster. So what we experienced in the pandemic was things like, we don't like going to the office. The things like, we don't like having our futures dependent onto other things that we can't control. And we don't like being isolated from one another. And so these are just trends that are now accelerating because we got greater contrast, greater pain of what we didn't want, and thus are moving forward. Human beings are just wired for freedom. Yeah. This is why, you know, I don't worry about government overreach because I know government doesn't work and freedom always wins. I don't worry about there being controllers of the world because I know freedom always wins. You can hold it back temporarily. You can try and suppress it, but all that does is increase more demand for freedom, which ultimately wins. And so what we're experiencing over the last 2 years is that a large number of people are experiencing the contrast of what they don't want and are pursuing a greater level of freedom because that's what we're wired to do. And entrepreneurship is that portal through which we not only become more, but we create more, we do more. And that requires a higher level of freedom, which is why we have a hard time getting people back to work, which is why we're having a hard time getting people to go back to the old way of doing things, because now there is increased desire for more freedom and you can never put that back in the can ever.
Hmm. So let me ask you this. What do you say? Because by the way, again, I'm waiting for you to say something that I don't 100% agree with, and it hasn't happened yet. So, but then I'm sure you experienced.
Just give me a minute, Jeff.
Yeah, I'll work on it. Eventually we'll get, if we stay on here long enough. Right. But I'm sure you experience, as I do, that you come across, you know, there's people that fundamentally, you know, regardless of our innate desire for freedom, they like what they perceive as the predictability and the security of a job. They're like, I know where everything stands. I organize my time accordingly from this time to this time. I belong to somebody else. And in exchange for that, they give me what I need for my mortgage and my car and my kids and da, da, da. And like, what do you say to that person who doesn't want what you're saying to be the case? They really want that in 2030 and 2040 and beyond, that they're still going to be able to operate in that matrix. You know, I call it the matrix. I don't want to get too woo-woo, but like, what do you say to that person? Like,
tough? I don't say anything to that person. Okay. Because the truth is, like, if that person is satisfied, if they are not experiencing the dissatisfaction of that, who am I to try and convince them to a different way? Right. So to try and persuade them out of that, or that their livelihood is going to go away, is something that they have to conclude for themselves. Hmm. And I have family members who have that life and are really happy. And I'm sometimes jealous of how happy they are because of their very structured, predictable life. Entrepreneurship is not predictable. Right. Like, isn't anything but predictable. It is giving up security in hopes of creating a higher level of freedom for ourselves with no guarantees. And so I don't try to persuade someone to go the entrepreneurial path. And there will always be different levels of structure that will exist as we go more and more entrepreneurial. So I don't believe in trying to persuade someone that they don't have a desire to do or desire to change. That is when we tend to dig our heels in and just argue with one another. And I'm more of a position, I want to build bridges rather than divide ourselves into groups.
Yeah, that's admirably laissez-faire of you. And there, maybe we found, although I wouldn't say it's a point of disagreement, it might be a point of distinction, that you're probably a little less aggressive than I am. I'm like out there like shaking bells in the streets, like, guys, wake up. We got this problem. And I don't want you to get caught flat-footed when it's too late. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has already said that your job's not going to exist in 8 years. And not, you know, don't shoot the messenger, but I don't want you to wait and find out the hard way. But you're like, hey, they'll figure it out. You know, when it's time, they'll come around. And until when they do, I'll be here. Right.
That's exactly right. When you experience the pain enough to want to change, I'll be here.
Yeah,
exactly right.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, frankly, those people, they're not listening to our podcast anyways.
That's right. Exactly right. And yeah, they're not buying our books.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, they're not at the store buying 12 months to $1 million on the bookshelf.
And if they do, I'm very happy that they do. Thank you very much. But those are where most of my one-star reviews come from.
Yeah. Yeah. This guy said things I don't like to hear. And so I'm going to try to cancel him through reviews.
Right.
Okay, cool. So let me back up a little bit. What's your story? Like, how did you get into this? I mean, you said you went to school to be a pastor, but I mean, like before, after, how'd you get where you are?
I always had the desire, always had the itch to be an entrepreneur. First business, 5 years old, selling hand-drawn pictures, door to door, knocking on doors in my neighborhood, trying to sell them for a penny each. I made 5 cents that night, but my dad supplied all of the paper. So it was 100% profit, Jeff.
It's a good deal.
And I was very involved in my church growing up. And if you understand my personality, it makes sense that I would want to be on stage in front of people talking about philosophical ideas. Mm-hmm. And so in my context, being a pastor made a lot of sense. But deep down, I knew I was doing that out of guilt and not out of desire. And I really wanted to create businesses. And so I started a side hustle from my college dorm room while I was in ministry school, doing affiliate marketing and search engine optimization and email marketing and pay-per-click advertising and just learning that game.
When was this?
This is 2006 to 2009.
Okay. So I just got to ask as a history buff, like what platform or program were you learning from at the time? Who was your guru du jour?
A lot of forums, wealthyaffiliate.com. I don't even know if that's still a thing.
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, they actually write bad reviews about me to try to poach my traffic. So I don't like that.
That's sad. I'm sorry to hear that. But there I met my longest standing mentor, Travis Sago, who I'm still very close with to this day, and built kind of a network and a community as a result of being in forums and chat rooms at the time and social media.
Were you in Warrior Forum?
Not actively, but okay. I knew what it was.
Yeah, of course.
So I was kind of coming up in that.
And by the way, I want my audience to know that means Ryan and I were kind of swimming in very closely related waters at about that same 2008, 2009 time. So
that's right. That's right. So I started that thinking that, okay, I'm going to make $30,000 a year as a pastor. So I've got to at least double that with a side hustle.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And all that did, of course, was kick up all that desire to be an entrepreneur and to grow and to expand, which continues the more success that you have. And so when I did not go the pastoral route, I went full-time entrepreneur. I had my freak out in my mid-20s, the quarter life crisis, like, okay, I know how to sell things on the internet, but what am I doing with my life? And I ended up putting everything that I own into my Kia Sportage, drove down to Austin, Texas in pursuit of a new life. And I've never left. And it was there that I discovered that my skill set of affiliate marketing, search engine optimization, email marketing applied really well to what we might call, Jeff, real businesses.
Yeah.
So when you take this skill set.
Wait, so what year was this?
2000. So this is 2011, 12, 13.
Okay. So this is like, I've told you, it's like there's some uncanny similarities already. My audience knows my story that 2012, 2013 is when I switched from affiliate marketing to my agency because of exactly what you just described. These skills apply. In fact, in many ways, they're more valuable.
They work way better.
Real business.
They work way better. Right. Yeah. So, but they always emerge out of the like make money world because we're ahead of the game. We're looking for the new platform. Mm-hmm. We're looking for the new white space.
Yeah.
So when applied to a real business, it's new and it's fresh and it works. So I applied it to e-commerce and it crushed and still crushes because e-commerce is still wide open for people who know this much about marketing to get in and build an audience and launch products to them. And that was my first $1 million business. So I kind of ran these numbers. I had my first product got to 25 sales a day. And I was selling it for about $30. And I was like, okay, so if I have four of these that are doing 25 sales a day, that's 100 sales a day at $30, that's $3,000 a day. That's $90,000 a month. And that's just over $1 million a year.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I saw the path, right? I had never had a $1 million business before. And that was the 4-minute mile for me. That was the threshold that I wanted that internally, that made me feel like I was a real entrepreneur.
Can you say those numbers again for the audience who may not have really processed how achievable $1 million business actually is?
My first product got to 25 sales a day at about a $30 price point. So I ran the numbers and realized that if I have four products doing 25 sales a day, that's 100 sales a day. And at a $30 price point, that's $3,000 a day, $90,000 a month, or about $1.1 million a year. And then I was like, okay, I just need to fill in these variables, Jeff.
Yeah.
I need to get the four products to 25 sales a day. I did it on one, so let's do it on a second one. And that became kind of the thesis through what I taught and what we built. That company ended up becoming a company we sold for eight figures. And that gave me the capital to build capitalism.com, which is now my full focus.
And so when was that? When did you start Capitalism?
I started Capitalism in 2017.
Okay. So I'm trying to think when I had that, it was actually a brunch, not a lunch with our mutual friend. And he was like, he was going to your, cause you have event, Capital Con is like an event, right?
The Capitalism Conference.
Or yes. Capitalism Conference. Yeah. So he was going there and I'm thinking that was maybe 2018 when he told me that. So that was, I didn't know the history, but that was pretty early for you.
Yeah, I documented my entire process of building that company from 2013 to 2017. So I was actually documenting and building my audience the entire time while I was building and growing that company that I ended up selling. And it was just in somewhere between 2015 and 2017 that I acquired the domain name capitalism.com. And then we moved all of our assets over in 2016 or 2017. So it was a very smooth transition into that. The event, I think, was 3 years old by the time that you heard about it.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So well played on the domain, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great story.
Before I remembered the name Ryan Daniel Moran, I remembered my buddy telling me that he was going to an event for capitalism.com. Like that sticks. That's the power of a great domain.
That's why we bought it. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Yeah. So can we talk about your book?
I'd love to. Thank you.
So the book is 12 months to a million or to $1 million.
Yep.
And again, I've seen this book now cause I follow you on Instagram. I see the book everywhere. And it sounds like it's been quite a hit for you. Is that a fair statement?
So our mission at capitalism.com is to help 1 million people become millionaires, 1 million millionaires. That's the financial equivalent of Bitcoin at its high, but put into the hands of entrepreneurs who we both know are the most impactful people in the world. And I love how you and I align on this idea of when you're in true service, that is when entrepreneurship actually becomes possible. Like it becomes now an expression of who you are and the change that you're having in the world. And so putting $1 trillion of value into the hands of entrepreneurs changes everything.
Yeah.
Changes everything. Wow. So I wrote the book as sort of the playbook, like here, go do this. Like this is how you build $1 million business. This is how you go from zero, no idea what you're doing, and month zero to month 12, having $1 million run rate. And some people have asked me what my marketing plan was for the book. And I said, to write a great frickin' book. That's the marketing plan.
Yeah,
create
a
great product. And so it has been very good to me. But I think you and I share in this idea of if you set out with the intent of just serving the person on the other side of the transaction and giving them a 100x return on the time and attention that they give you, then the numbers sort of take care of themselves. It has done really well.
Yeah, I'm curious, as somebody who just a couple months ago put the finishing touches on a book, how long did it take you to write the book? I'm just curious.
18 months.
Okay. Yeah.
18 months. Yeah.
Like writing a book. I'm curious. Can you talk a little bit about your experience of writing a book? Like obviously there's the work that you did, but like, what did the work do to you?
That's a wonderful question, Jeff. What the work did to me was it forced me to sort of bleed on the pages and give everything that I have to the end reader. And it made me think about, I had this mentor tell me once that in content, the way that you really build your audience is to treat every time you're in front of the camera or in front of the microphone as if it is the last word that you could leave to society. Mm. Like, to treat each piece of content with that amount of intent. And that has been hard for me to replicate outside of a book, because there's so much prep and thought that goes into it that it made me slow down and say, if I only get one shot, if I leave it all on this court, what do I want to leave someone with? And that becomes the filter through which what gets kept in the book.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. And I'm just having this realization now that that is one of my most viral pieces of content. And I think that is the case when you take that sort of a mindset of, okay, I want to leave whoever interacts with this as though it is my last word of what I have to say about this. If I could only leave them with one thing, I would give them this. And that it forced me to think like that rather than what I would get out of them.
Yeah, that's so interesting. That way of thinking, like, yeah, it's almost like, not even if this is the last thing they could get from me, but if this is literally the only time they would ever meet or know me, is this one thing. And I'm with you. If somebody, I mean, my book's not out yet, but if somebody, you know, if my dad was like, I want you to meet your long lost uncle and he wants to get to know you and make up for missing 40 years of your life, how I would be like, here, give him this book. It's all of me that I have to give to someone, you know, or maybe that was a weird example, but, so what did you learn about yourself from writing the book?
Writing the book brought up a lot of imposter syndrome for me. It brought up a lot of questions about whether I was really capable of helping another human being. Right. I think we all have that at different levels in our career. And I think that part of entrepreneurship is undoing the egoic idea of being seen as smart, being seen as capable, being seen as successful. The faster that you can undo that, the more that success is there for you. And I had plenty to undo and still do. And the book brought up a lot of it for me and forced me to take myself out of the equation and put someone else as the object of my focus. Mm-hmm. And that was hard. That was hard. There were times that a lot of that came up for me. And working through that is some of the best therapy that you'll do, which is why I think entrepreneurship is the greatest self-development program ever developed, because what you give is oftentimes a direct reflection of how you view yourself. Mm-hmm. And I wish it wasn't, right? I wish it was easier than that. I wish there was more of a step-by-step plan for that.
Yeah.
But I think it requires that you let go of self and think about the other person, and only then can you serve them.
So I want to dig deeper on that. But before we do, I want to go back, because I completely just align with everything you're saying. I talk a lot about entrepreneurship is the crucible in which a lot of the best of us forge ourselves. And it just forces you to deal with stuff that, frankly, in the absence of it, it's like, why entrepreneur? Because if you don't, you'll probably go your whole life avoiding some things that you shouldn't.
Well said. Well said.
And I agree with you on that, but I also know from experience that, a lot of, you know, there's this line. Have you ever seen the movie Neverending Story?
Oh yeah. A long time ago.
Yeah. Right. Right. From when we were kids, and there, when the old scientist, he's like, most men confronted with their true selves run away screaming. They look in the magic mirror gate and they can see their human other side outside of Fantasia, and they don't like what they see. And I actually think that's the mirror of entrepreneurship for a lot of people. They go, I don't want this. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to tackle it. I don't want to. And when they say it, they really mean themselves. And so I'm always interested. And frankly, if I could say, what is the entire point of this podcast? It's to try to distill the answer to this question. What is the difference in the people that will stare into that mirror and even walk through it versus the people that run away screaming. And so for you, I'm curious, going back to whether it was your affiliate marketer days or your college dorm days, like whenever you started to realize what an existential challenge entrepreneurship really is, what drew you towards it instead of pushing you away from it?
I think it goes back to the conversation that we had about trying to convince people to become entrepreneurs. It is either a deep level of pain or a brighter, compelling future. It has to be one of those two things. You've either experienced enough pain that you say no more and I will change, or you have such a compelling vision for a life that you desire. And sometimes it's a mix of those two things working opposite to push you in that direction. And this is why I don't try to persuade other people, because if they don't have a more compelling future, then they're probably going to fail as an entrepreneur. Yeah. And if they don't have an underlying pain to change, then they're probably going to try a few things and then give up. And so for me, it was a mix of those two things, of a desire for a much greater level of life, a much greater level of service, and a deep fear that it would that my life would go without that. And that is, I think that's how we're wired to change in every area of life. If you want to change your fitness, you've got to have one of two things.
Yeah.
You need to have a deep dissatisfaction with where you are, or a much brighter, compelling future for where you're going to go. And that is all up here. It is all your inner game, all what's going on in your head. And I don't think that short-term money is enough to give somebody those two things. Because you can make short-term money in a job or in an MLM or whatever you want it to be. And so I think it comes down to what you are avoiding and what you are in pursuit of. And the only thing that you can do, in my opinion, to be able to try and hack that in somebody is to get them to sit and think about what they want their life to actually look like. What do they wish could be true? What do they wish they could create? What do they wish that they could bring about in the world? And when you can get them dreaming like that, all of a sudden the compelling future contrasted with the life that they're living now becomes both the pain that pushes them forward and the compelling future that brings them to the other side.
And so, I mean, beautifully said. So I'm curious, was there someone or some experience, something formative in your life that you think gave you that permission, whether it was permission to dream or created a sense of frustration or despondence or whatever with, call it, the life more ordinary, whatever you would have had otherwise? Like was there something that planted that seed in you early on where it was inevitable that you would go this way?
Interesting question. And I haven't thought about this before, but when you ask that question, I'm thinking about a man who mentored me when I was a teenager, who drove the nice car. He owned a couple Corvettes, had a really nice house in Northeast Ohio. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And my parents had just split, and my mom asked him to take an interest in me. Mm-hmm. And he did for a short time, but he ended up, like, I discovered about him, he had his own demons too. And towards the end of our relationship, he did and said some things that were really hurtful. And I was really hurt by some things that he did. And he had always told me that if I did what he said, I would be a millionaire by the time I was 30. So I said, I want to beat you by 5 years. Mm. And I've never processed that, of like, that was probably an underlying drive to overcome that pain of that relationship. I beat him by 4. So I was a millionaire.
Oh, I was going to ask how close. But, so 26?
26. Okay. So I'll take it. Yeah. But that was an underlying shift in me of saying, all right, I'm not going to follow that path. I'm going to beat it by 5 years. And I got real close. But as an interesting question, I had never thought about that before, Jeff. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. It's interesting. I'm so fascinated by, again, and you and I have talked, I was on, you know, for anybody that doesn't know, I was on Ryan's show, the capitalism.com podcast. And we talked a lot about trauma and therapy and doing that sort of gritty, painful work. And I'm always so fascinated by how we reprocess later in life things that happen to us younger, when we're younger, because I feel like when we're young, these things, like, they cut us really deep because we're soft, but we're really bad at figuring out what things mean.
Yeah, right.
And then we get older and we try to, like, unpack, like, subconsciously, we try to, like, I don't know if we're packing the wound or unpacking it, but we're trying to nurture ourselves by figuring out the meaning of these things that cut us. And it's, and I really think that that, however people's lives play out, unless you create a space of intentionality and awareness around that part of life, you just end up with the results of that process happening subconsciously, you know? So that's why I asked this question. I'm so fascinated because I want people to realize, and I'm curious for you, did you learn, like, did you ever go through a process of learning to rewire yourself or alter the meaning that you ascribe to things that have happened to you, or in fundamental ways change your trajectory? Or were you just kind of preset to be successful, do you think? And I don't mean that as a disparaging way of saying it. You know what I mean, though? Like,
no, there's a saying that I have heard where if you don't deal with your own internal demons or your own internal stuff, don't worry, they'll get bigger. Yeah. If you don't deal with them now, don't worry, they'll come up later,
right?
And then you'll deal with them later. Like, when they become big enough for you to deal with, then you will deal with them. And yes, I have gone through long periods of cutting up the weeds and digging mm-hmm. them up. And I wish, Jeff, there was a point in which the weeds just didn't grow anymore.
Yeah.
But we go through life and we pick up more stuff and it activates other stuff, and that makes it bigger for us to pull out those weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so that idea of, as you grow, new stuff comes up. I think it's a constant, never-ending process of you pulling out the weeds and dealing with them. I hope that even Jeff Bezos has things he's working through, mm-hmm. right? And like, I know Elon Musk is, and we're like, that's the game we're playing. Like, the game that we're actually playing is creating higher levels of freedom, not just financially, but how that allows us to free up more creative capacity within ourselves,
mm-hmm.
how that allows us to create more mental freedom to move forward. That is the actual game that we are playing. And then you have kids and they expose all kinds of stuff that's in you that you didn't know was in there. And so as we go through life, we're just picking up more that brings up, there's a therapist named Peter Crone who says life has a way of showing you where you are not free. And so we go through these experiences and we find reflected back to us the areas where we are not free. And those are the areas that we work through, and it creates a different level of freedom that gives us a bigger platform from which we grow and find that next level of where we aren't free.
Yeah.
And the human evolution is in pursuit of greater and greater levels of freedom, which is a beautiful thing, but it is never ending work.
So what is your, do you have specific things in your life that you would refer to as either, you know, call it like preventative maintenance, right? Like the weeding of the garden, and or also the proactive improvement, more of like the gardening of the garden. Like,
yeah.
What are your processes for that you do on a continuous basis?
You know, I go to therapy. I've gone down the psychedelic rabbit holes. I'm so not in that mode of life right mm-hmm. now, but I've gone, you know, I yelled cannonball into that pool.
Right.
But I have
found, big in Austin. If you get back into it, it's all around you. From what
yes. I could step outside and go to the planet Zarkon, if you will. but I have found no better process for continual maintenance than Brooke Castillo's model. And Brooke Castillo's model is CTFAR. We have circumstances in our life, and then we have our thoughts about them. Our thoughts create our feelings drive our actions, and our actions drive our results. And so we can sort of look at any area of our life and plot it out into that model and then explore what's going on. So if I had a frustrating day at work, okay, how am I feeling? I'm feeling frustrated. What are my thoughts that are creating that frustration? It shouldn't be like this. Okay, mm-hmm. What was the circumstance in which I reacted in that way? How is that driving my actions and what results am I getting out of this? So where can I intercept into this? Where can I intercept this model? Change a thought, change a feeling, change an action, change one of those things. And I can sort of intercept the mental banter that's going on that has me feeling frustrated or lack mentality. And I found that to be the most effective maintenance play for me.
Okay, so we are in deep waters here and we are going to-
Let's go deeper.
This is amazing. So Brooke, for anybody that doesn't know, creator of the Life Coach School, she's in Austin, right?
Lives down the street.
So I've talked, my audience is reasonably familiar, I guess, depending how, it's been a while, but depending how far back they've gone. I talk a lot about something called the Ellis paradigm, which Albert Ellis was creator of rational emotive behavior therapy. And it's a very similar model, right? And it's all about the disputation of the meaning that we assign to things to create consciousness so that we can choose a different course of action by changing the narrative around the story we're telling ourselves about, you know, the guy that cut us off in traffic, or the reason that customers aren't converting in my funnel, or the reason my girlfriend broke up with me, or like whatever the thing is. It's not the thing, it's the meaning you assign to the thing.
That's right.
That determines how you feel about it and thus what you do about it, right? And so it's like right. You talked about, it's this like intervention into your own unconscious processing to change the meaning and then change your thus change your options, right? And so I've been talking about this disputation, which I know Brooke, I met her, or I've heard of her on Mike Dillard's show.
Yeah.
And I've hacked her business model, and I actually probably know more about her business than her.
They met here at my house.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. It's small
in this
world.
Room, actually.
That's interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
Mike's a good friend. And, so anyway, I want to get into this because I had a very clumsy period of my life when my wife and I started going to therapy. We got exposed to Albert Ellis and this whole paradigm, which again, different words, maybe different names, but same concept. And we were like accountability partners, my wife and I, for probably 2 years of like, I can see you getting triggered. First of all, take some time, because I don't want to come at you if it's going to trigger you more. But when you're ready, let's walk through the exercise, right? And we would support each other in teasing out the meanings that we were defaulting to and substituting in different meanings and then discussing different courses of actions. But for us, it was super painful. It was super clumsy. It was super annoying to anybody who happened to be around us. It was like, oh, you guys are doing therapy again. And it took like 2 years to get to where there was any elegance or automation to how it happens in my mind. Like 2 years of laborious practice. So I'm curious, did you like go through like any kind of boot camp or like long transformational period of practicing this? Because it sounds so good on the surface, but it's really damn hard to do well.
I think it's practice, Jeff. I mean, can you remember those early phases when you were going through therapy, how resistant you were to your own negative thoughts? Like, no, that's not in me. That's in that person. That person is making me feel that way.
Oh yeah. Everything's everybody else's.
Exactly. That's how we all start. It's how we all start. I think you have to go through that clunky period. Like I wish that there was a way around that. And some people will say that psychedelics are that. And thankfully there is plenty of research in phase 3 trials of psychedelic use in proper settings, proper therapeutic settings. And those can be, when like well guided, they can be a bit of a cheat code. Right? Mm-hmm. They can open up a lot and show you what you have to deal with. But I don't think anybody gets the fast track to self-awareness.
Yeah.
I think self-awareness is the response to you hitting a certain level and not wanting to experience that pain anymore. Like, I think it is how we say, okay, this is how my brain created this life. and therefore I need to change things. There is one book that is very good at exposing some of this. It's called The Last Word on Power. And Brooke Castillo turned me on to this book. And it is based from an entrepreneurial perspective, I think brings out a lot of what we are talking about in sort of a structured way. And The Last Word on Power will basically argue that every success-driven person has a playbook that they're running around in their brain. She calls it the winning strategy. And the winning strategy is how we got to where we are. But once we're there, we don't want to give up the winning strategy. And so we tend to stay on a hamster wheel of being stuck in the same place over and over again. And we have to expose that and let it go and chart a new chapter, chart a new winning strategy and a new direction to go, which is really freaking scary when you haven't done that before. It requires letting go of this defensive person that we created to get to this point. And so that from an entrepreneurial context, find that to be very interesting. And combined with Brooke Castillo's work, that's my cheat code, if you will. That's my boot camp, Jeff.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the ultimate, what got you here won't get you there.
Exactly.
But it's like in here.
Yes.
And it's like what built you this won't build you that. So I'm curious for you, man, this is like really, really cool. Could you describe, cause I feel like I get in this stuff. Like I geek out in these types of conversations when I get to talk to, you know, high level people that are not scared of this work and have done a lot of it, have done enough of it over a long enough period of time to really like use their life to prove how well it works, so to speak. These are the conversations I could have for hours. But sometimes I feel like maybe they can be a little esoteric if people are like, bro, I'm just trying to learn how to, like, I just want to start a business. Like, can you tell me what to do? And you guys are talking about reinventing your winning strategy or whatever. And so I'm curious, is there any way you could articulate in your own life, even maybe whether in the past or the present, like, hey, this is what got me to a point, again, past or present. And this is what I had to discover about what got me to that point or this point in order to figure out how I was going to get to the next point, or even maybe potentially now, if you're vulnerable and there's something that comes to mind of like, how am I going to get where I want to go? What does this deconstruction, reconstruction actually look like in practical form in a life?
I'll give you a really surface level one, and then we'll go a level deeper.
Okay.
So the surface level one would be, imagine selling a $50 product versus selling a $50,000 product. And just notice how you feel about those two things.
Yeah.
That's where your work begins. Because selling a $50 product, you have your own thoughts about what the value needs to be, but what it needs to look like. And then a $50,000 product and who that's for and what that needs to look like and what value that needs to create.
And by the way, are you part of the $50,000 product? It's not like a Mercedes. Is it like something that Ryan is a part of?
That's what I was imagining.
Yeah.
But even if you were to say a $50,000 Mercedes, your perception of how you show up for that potential customer tells you everything that you believe about yourself. That's where it starts. Now, a level deeper and something that's going on with me right now is I am in negotiations. I don't know if it's going to go through at the time of this recording. A deal's not done. But I am in negotiations to buy back my old company that I sold in 2017. And I have all kinds of stuff coming up about, well, do I still have it? Like, am I still good at this? If I document this a second time, will I fail? What does it mean if I fail publicly? What does it mean if I lose money or I lose investors' money?
Yeah. And should you quit while you're ahead?
Right.
Right. You're one for one.
So, I wouldn't say one for one. We all have a closet full of failures, Jeff. But in this one documented experience, yeah, it worked. And I built my audience around it. So what happens if I do it and it doesn't work out? What happens if investors are disappointed? What happens if, who knows what happens? What if I find out that I don't enjoy it or I lose the lifestyle that's actually pretty comfortable right now?
Yeah.
So who do I need to become in order to be okay as someone who lost money, okay, as somebody who lost reputation? Because only then are you free to actually go do it. Only then. And so that's the transformation I'm going through right now. which is this identity of a certain level of success, of putting myself out there, of being willing to fail. And it's clunky and it's hard. And the one of the reasons I decided to go through with the pursuit of this deal was because I saw it as an opportunity for me to deal with that.
Yeah.
Right. It will force me to become a different type of person. And it's a type of person that I want to be, Jeff.
Yeah.
Like, I want to become that person. I am not the person capable of making that $100 million company, but I want to become that person. I want to be the person who is qualified to be given that level of responsibility. And that requires admitting that I'm not right now, requires admitting that I don't have what it takes right now, but I'm willing to become that person. In fact, I don't even know how to become that person, but I will set out to figure out who that person is. And I mean, quite honestly, like a $100 million company sounds cool. It looks good egoically, but that's not enough of a driver to force you to go through the hard stuff.
Right, right, right.
Something has to be more compelling. And for me, that is the compelling idea of being that type of person.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when like you're already good. Like you're not, if you want a boat, you can go buy a boat. If you want a G-Wagon, you go buy a G-Wagon. Like, you know what I mean? You don't need a $100 million company to have all the trappings of a great life. There's got, like, you're right. You're right. There's gotta be something more. Real quick, how big, do you mind if I ask, like, how big is your team? How many people do you lead on a daily basis?
There's six of us.
Okay. By the way, well played building such a successful and highly visible and you know, dominant organization in your space with such a lean staff.
Thank you. Thank you. That's intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. Intentional. I mean, well played there. Geez, I'm like embarrassed to tell you how many people and by the way, like that's like between entrepreneurs, like you want to do more with less. Like that's like high praise when I tell like, Ryan, I'm so impressed at how lean your company is. Right. It's not like, I want to have 100 employees, so I sound like a big deal. No, if you can do it with 10, you should.
But this is comparison syndrome at its finest happening right now.
Right. Right.
Because your company's 10 times ish the size of ours revenue wise. Right. I don't know what your bottom line is. That doesn't matter.
Right.
Your team is much bigger than mine. And I know that my leadership capabilities max out at about seven people right now. Hmm. And my team's never been bigger than seven. And so part of that is like learning to be a leader of seven people before I become a leader of 70 people.
Yeah. So it's interesting because what I was going to ask you about is the reason I asked about your team. It was not because so we could do, I'll show you mine, you show me yours. It was so we could talk about the dynamic of taking on these personal challenges in the context of leadership, where one of the key elements of leadership obviously is sort of, you know, to some degree, a perception of stability or consistency. And I think that I'm just going to be speak from I for a second, that when I take on, I'm going through kind of a similar level of hey, I there's some things I need to develop and evolve right now. But I find myself erring on the side of what I'll call caution, although I could almost potentially even call it self-sabotage that I euphemistically label as caution, because it's like, I don't want to be seen as unstable transforming in front of the people I'm supposed to be leading. It's like, I want to look like I've already got it all figured out and there's no, the boat needs no rocking. And I'm curious, if with leading a team, if that ends up being a factor of like, yeah, I know what I need to do, but I'm stopping myself from doing it because I need to appear so consistent to these people.
Of course, that's a thing.
Okay. Yeah, right? Good.
I think that is, that almost is the definition of leadership. Like the definition of leadership is knowing where you need to go before everyone else agrees with you. And then having the wherewithal to trust your own judgment over the voices of 50 other people.
Yeah.
And being okay if some don't follow. Which, by the way, I can only talk about philosophically, right? Like, that is a never-ending process that I don't think anyone ever gets good at. But the leadership is having a vision that you are moving towards and saying, I'm going this way. And other people saying, I don't think so. And you saying, no, I am resolved in going this way. This is where we are going. Mm-hmm. Are you coming with me? And but part of that is understanding what you could lose by charting out that territory and going down that direction and being okay with that loss. Yeah. And there are leaders who are defined by defensive leadership, holding the line, being the integrator, making systems really smooth. And one other form of leadership, and you need both, is saying, no, we are going here.
Yeah.
Let's go. We're going here. And there are different times call for a different type of leadership. So it is really a matter of which leadership style your company needs right now to match the vision that's in your head.
Well, thank you. Yes, I appreciate the free consulting slash therapy.
You and me both, buddy. You and me both.
So I'm curious, you know, you work with, what would you say is, and actually, I don't want to assume, what is kind of like the entry point into working with capitalism.com? Are you working mostly with people that already have going concerns and they're trying to scale or startups or what?
I mean, my bread and butter is I take people from zero to their first million.
Okay.
And our core product center is called the 1%. And the 1% has three different levels to it. Grind, growth, gold. The grind is about choosing your product, launching it, getting it to the first 10K. Growth is about going from 10K to 80K. So you're pacing $1 million. Growth is casting a compelling vision and growing a business that you can sell, a seven-figure business that you can sell. So the 1%, only 1% of people ever become millionaires. And so we're out to create 1 million millionaires. And so you go through the 1% to go through that ascension of launch, growing to the first million, and then casting a vision beyond the first million, building a seven-figure business that you can sell. So that's our bread and butter. And depending on where somebody is in the process, they'll enter into our world. I'd say more than 50% of our customers are saying, all right, I have an idea. I want to bring this to market. And so they start inside of that first part of the 1%.
So what do you see? What would you say is the one or maybe few biggest, maybe like you talked about the unlearning, right? You have to undo some of this stuff. What do you feel like are some of the biggest, call them misconceptions that need to be unraveled for people that are coming in to your world with an idea, but maybe also no clue, to be fair?
You know?
Like, what's it really going to take? Like, what do you think those things are?
Well, on the surface, it's selling a product versus selling to a person. People obsess so much about the product and undervalue the person who's on the other side of that and crafting it specifically for them. That's the surface level answer. But the deeper behind that is more the sense of getting something versus giving something. When I'm thinking about a product, I'm often thinking about what I can sell, at what price point, at what margin, for me to be able to take home enough money to feel safe,
right,
or free. But when I'm serving a person, I'm thinking about what impact I can have on that person, which is actually a much more enjoyable way to build a business.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires that we undo ourselves in that, which can be a very long process.
Yeah.
This can be a very unearthing process of I want to give to this person rather than I want to get something. And we can all feel that disconnect of when someone is giving to us in order to cash the check. You feel that. That's what being sold feels like. But when there's a genuine interest for the other person, no sales is necessary. And that is the unearthing process that I think has been the most dramatic for me, or maybe the hardest lesson for me to learn, realizing how selfish I am, Jeff, realizing how empty I must feel to try and get from other people. And realizing how much selfishness is in there and how mm-hmm. much that holds me back. And what to do about that, how you bridge that gap. And bridging that gap is the work.
Yeah.
Bridging that gap when you have a full cup allows you to give and create and be in a state of service to other people, which is when you end up getting everything that you want and you don't need it anymore. You're no longer attached to it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, and it's interesting because if you're right, which I happen to agree with you about where we started, which is that entrepreneurship is the way. Don't tell, blanking on his name, like the most famous, who's the Stoic guy? He's like super famous. He has a book.
Ryan Holiday.
Ryan Holiday. Yeah. Don't tell him. Cause he says the obstacle is the way. We're saying entrepreneurship is the way, right? Which is actually the obstacle full of obstacles, right?
That's right.
but anyway, assuming you're right, like I said, which I agree, that is the way. And that way requires this undoing and this unlearning and this ultimately this journey to selflessness, to give you support on your show, when I was on your show, I talked about, it took me 39 years to finally admit that I've been a taker my whole life.
Mm.
And I'm going to at least experiment with trying to be a true, authentic giver wholly. And that's a daily struggle, but at least we can admit that we, you know, have that work to do. Right.
Right.
But you're right. Just how extraordinarily selfish we are by nature. Like it's biological. It's really damn hard to override.
Yeah.
And so what we're really saying then, if entrepreneurship is the way in the future that we're fast heading towards, and successful entrepreneurship, as you put it, I think I can't remember if it even was on this conversation or the conversation we had on your show, but you were talking about when you were talking to Alex Hormozi and you were talking about how it's this process through which you discover how to let go of trying to get and learn to selflessly give. And ironically, then you actually finally get, so to speak.
It's the beautiful irony of entrepreneurship.
Then what we're actually saying is that unlearning is the way.
That's right.
Which means whether you want to be an entrepreneur or not, you almost don't have much say in the matter of we have to all learn how to give rather than take.
Exactly right. That is exactly right. And the process of taking requires that you go through that. So in order to get what you want,
mm-hmm.
you have to give more than you expect to get. It's kind of like, we're both into fitness.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just get to 1-2, skip a few 99 six-pack abs.
Right.
You have to give a certain amount, give a deficit of calories.
You have to give a lot and it's hard.
Yes. Yes.
To get a tiny little improvement.
That's exactly right. And entrepreneurship is that times 10.
Yeah.
Because if you want to get $2,000, be ready to give $20,000 worth of value.
Yeah.
Which requires you believing that you can, which is such a process of discovering how to take yourself out of the equation and serve someone else. And that beautiful irony is that as soon as you learn that it's not about you, you can have everything that you want.
Man, that's a, I think we're just, I'm going to let that ring in the air for a sec. We're about out of time. And that's that is a beautiful, elegant punctuation mark. How can people go deeper into your world? Book, social, capitalism.com, everything. Share, please.
Yeah. I mean, I'm my own name, Ryan Daniel Moran on YouTube. The most effective and affordable, cost-effective way that I can serve you is for you to go download or torrent or steal the book, which is called 12 Months to 1 Million. If you want to get it from the library, that's fine. If you want to torrent it, I don't care. Or you can just get it on Audible or Amazon.com. There's 12 Months to 1 Million. It's how to pick a winning product, build a real business, and become a seven-figure entrepreneur. And that is the best gateway drug into the world of capitalism.com.
I can't wait until my book comes out and I can say this. I'm like, I can just be like, just get my book.
It's the now gateway drug.
I gotta send them to my YouTube channel or whatever. Man.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.